I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, what have we learned about China in watching the Olympics? But first, reports today that new information has surfaced about the ages of some of the competitors on the Chinese gymnastics team, and the International Olympic Committee is now investigating. Several teams had previously complained that the Chinese were competing with underage athletes. Well, Boston Globe sports writer Shira Springer is in Beijing. Shira, what are you hearing first about the Chinese gymnastics team?
Well, this is something we've been hearing throughout the Olympics from the very start of the women's gymnastics competition, but it sort of picked up steam when the IOC said it was going to investigate, as will the International Gymnastics Federation. So it looks like the original claims by the Chinese that their athletes were of age and the presentation of passports that showed the athletes were of age are no longer sufficient, because there have been articles in Chinese newspapers that have indicated that some of the female gymnasts are as young as 13 and 14 years old.
Well, we'll talk about what it means that there have been articles in Chinese newspapers that have said that these kids are 13. But let's turn to sports with you, track and field. Last night, several crushing disappointments. The U.S. men's and women's teams both dropped batons in the 4x100 qualifying round, so they didn't even run today. Now, don't tell us who did win and run today. But what was the reaction to dropping those batons?
Absolute disbelief. Not only did they both teams drop batons, but they both dropped it in the exchange from the third leg to the anchor leg. So they had only one exchange left to go, and they couldn't get the baton around. Nobody thought the 4x100 teams would fail to make the final. Yeah, there was the assumption that they were so determined after previous defeats earlier in the game to win a gold medal for the U.S.
We understand, Shira, that one of the things that might have happened is that they hadn't run as teams in the lineup they were in?
Well, that's one possibility. I think there was also some concern that, for instance, Tyson Gay, who dropped the baton, hadn't been with the team in the training camp to practice the handoff. But listen, they practice all different types of combinations. They've been at this for a couple of weeks here in Beijing. They've been at it for about a week at their training camp in Dalian, China. These are professional athletes. They know how to get the job done, and they simply didn't, no matter what order they were in.
Well, there are big contests still ahead, the men's 8 and 5,000-meter finals, the women's 1,500 meters, the 4x400 meters. Just tell us what to be looking for.
Well, I think it'll be interesting, the men's 5,000 with Bernard Lagat, the Kenyan who is now an American citizen, who is the reigning world champion. It would really be something if an American, quote-unquote, can win that event. And there's an outside shot in the women's 1,500 for a woman named Shannon Robery to come away with the medal. And again, that would be quite something for America, because it's not typically both events, the 5,000, men's 5,000 and the women's 1,500, are not typically events where the U.S. is strong.
Well, there's also the marathons coming up. What should we look for from any country there?
I'm going to point out another American. Ryan Hall has been running particularly well, and he could bring home a medal for the Americans, which would be a nice conclusion to the sort of track and field events or the running events for the Americans here.
Well, there's also a gold medal match coming up between Nigeria and Argentina in men's soccer, the men's 10-meter platform diving finals. But we just want to talk briefly about volleyball. They're heading to the finals this weekend, a bittersweet angle to this story. It was the father-in-law of the head coach of the U.S. men's volleyball team who was fatally stabbed in Beijing. The head coach's wife is a former women's player. That's going to be probably an emotional match.
Yeah, I mean, this is, bar none, the emotional story of the game. The first time, I believe, since 1988, the Olympics, that the U.S. men have reached a gold medal game in men's volleyball. And then the women are there as well, competing for the gold medal. And everybody knows what's driving them. It is in the memory of Todd Bachman, who was stabbed in the very early days of the Beijing game. The Bachman family is well known in U.S. volleyball circles. The Bachmans were sort of the parents of U.S. volleyball in some way. So it has been an emotional Olympics, and I think nothing would please the volleyball teams more than to do this in memory of Todd Bachman.
Shira Springer, Boston Globe sports reporter in Beijing. Shira, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, the Olympics may be the most expensive and most watched event in human history, But maybe we've watched it around the world through different prisons. Chinese expert Claire Kunsisan joins us again. Claire is an associate professor of drama at Tufts University, a researcher at Harvard University's Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies. And Claire, you were with us when the Olympics first started 2 weeks ago to tell us what to look for. And now you're telling us what we've seen. So let's start to do that. And let's start first with the Chinese gymnasts. Shira was just saying, you know, yes, there's an investigation into their age, but she also said that the Chinese newspapers were all writing about the girls' ages. I mean, people must know how old these children are. They know people. How, you know, that seems quite unusual. It seems like years ago we would never see it speculated about in the papers.
Well, I think... Hi, Robin. It's great to be here. I think that this has been a very exciting Olympics, and it's brought up a lot of really interesting subjects to the surface. And one of the sports in which a lot of dialogue has been happening is gymnastics, both the new scoring system and the idea of the new age rule that was instituted in 1997, raising the age from 15 to 16. And I think the Chinese people are discussing it because everybody wants to know how old are these gymnasts. But it's complex because sometimes when the gymnasts enter the training system as young girls, the parents may actually say that they're younger than they are, and maybe the ages are being corrected, or perhaps they are younger than what they're claiming to be. It's very hard to predict what the outcome of that will be.
But we should say that in the case of many of these Chinese gymnasts, it has been reported that when they entered other competitions where you have to show your passport, their ages were older than they suddenly are now. They've gotten younger with time. So it's been documented previously that they were older.
Right. And I think there's some confusion both in the Western media and in China itself about that.
Well, as we said, the investigation opens. We'll see. But it's not the only controversy. There have been many. A Washington Post story has the headline, "Something Else at the Olympics Rings False." The list goes on: the fake fireworks, the substitution of the girl singer at the opening ceremony who is considered, you know, better looking. Now, some would say, you know, how can Americans, the home of Hollywood, criticize China for maybe some fakery? But I want to ask you about what's being called the case of the fake children. During the opening ceremonies, there were 56 children. We remember them. They were around the Chinese flag. They were meant to represent China's 56 ethnic minorities. But it turns out they were all from an arts troupe, almost entirely made up of the dominant Han Chinese ethnic group. Now, the Washington Post writes, this would be like an American opening ceremony having all white children pretend to be Native American Indians or African Americans. That's the parallel. What does it mean to you?
Well, I think this is an interesting example of the lens through which we choose to see this fact, because if you look at it through a political lens or the kind of American point of view of ethnic authenticity, one would see it the way you just mentioned. But if we go back to what we talked about when I visited the program before and looking through the lens of performance and the staging of performance and spectacle, it's not as upsetting to think about children who have the training to be out there in that spectacle and to be waiting backstage and to hold themselves properly during the performance to then be representing the ethnic multiplicity of the Chinese people. So from the Chinese point of view, it may not be as disturbing as it is from our American political point of view whether the children are really the ethnic minorities or whether what's really important is the message of representing that ethnic diversity in China.
Well, sure, and you did remind us before that other countries looked at our Olympics in Utah, in Salt Lake, and there was a Mormon... there was a group of Mormons who came on and, you know, representing the Mormons who came to Utah and seemed to the rest of the world to push the Native American Indians who were also on the stage off the stage. And it made it look like genocide when, in fact, it was just a theatrical moment. And in all likelihood, the Mormons probably weren't played by Mormons and maybe the Indians not by Indians.
Not all of them. I don't know. Yeah, and certainly it seemed to represent a kind of displacement of a people. I'm not sure other nations read it that way, but personally, myself, as a performance studies professor, I saw it that way when I was watching it. And so for the same reason that kind of jarred me in seeing that physical displacement of a people, knowing that this is just a performative representation of ethnic difference isn't as disturbing from a performance lens. Although, personally, I do wish that they had actually put children on stage who were from... those
groups.
Right. And I think the problem is that the media guide seemed to imply in its English translation for the Western media that these children really were from those groups.
Right. So there was a ballerina who we learned was seriously injured, possibly paralyzed for life in a rehearsal. We found out about that. The Chinese government talked about that in the government-run newspapers eventually. But there were also the protesters who were arrested. Now, were you surprised? The Chinese government said that they were going to allow people to protest. They just had to come and sign up to protest. And as soon as they did, including two elderly women who had never spoken out against the Chinese government, they have trouble walking. One is blind in one eye. And they went to apply for a protest. They wanted to protest something having to do with their homes being taken for redevelopment. And they were sentenced to re-education. Were you surprised at a sort of flip-flop, the government saying, we're going to allow protests, just come register, and then what happened when people did?
I'm not surprised at how the Chinese government has handled this entire situation. There seem to be some contradictions in how the government is trying to handle this idea of being a modern nation on the global stage and still trying to keep its people in check the way it does through its authoritarian system of government. But even though it doesn't surprise me, because I've watched China for almost 20 years now, of course it's going to cause conversation and some distress. Because when you give the Olympics to a modern nation that's still under a communist government, you can't just expect them to stage an Olympics with a Western American democratic standard. And so they're negotiating, trying to understand what the world expects from them, and also trying to control the image that the world is getting of China. And part of controlling it is trying to keep dissenters silenced. And of course, I don't like to see that happen, but it doesn't surprise me as a China scholar.
Well, we understand that outside of Beijing and in other, you know, the rural parts of the country, people aren't really watching and have problems of their own, including recovering from that terrible earthquake. But I'm just wondering, in the couple minutes we have, as a China watcher, as you watched, how'd you feel?
Well, I think anywhere that there's televisions in China right now, people are watching the Olympics. And what I've been hearing from my friends in Beijing and Shanghai, which is where my research bases are, there are televisions everywhere. And this has always been the case, but now they've also mounted huge screen televisions in about 26 public spaces.
So do you think they're taking in, and what did you as a China watcher take in?
I think people are excited about the Olympic Games. They're excited that their country is on the world stage, as I mentioned. They're interested in finding more information. This is a chance for the Chinese people to have a larger flow of information than might be usual. There is a difference between the countryside and the urban areas, and I think that's what that author was pointing out, that the rural China has not advanced and benefited economically the same way urban dwellers have, and this is being noticed.
Do you think that this past 2 weeks means China will never be the same? Or not?
A lot of sinologists have been discussing this question. I think China has to be changed by the experience of having the Olympics, and I think the rest of the world's ideas about China have to be changed by the fact that the Olympics happened in China.
Claire Conceson, associate professor of drama at Tufts and a researcher at Harvard University's Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies. Her forthcoming book, Voices Carry, is the autobiography of the late Chinese actor and vice minister of culture Ying Rucheng.
Ying Rucheng.
Ying Rucheng. Well, we will have you back then, Claire. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
The Associated Press is now reporting that Texas Congressman Chet Edwards is a finalist in the search for Barack Obama's vice president. With apologies to Texas. Who? Here's what Obama had to say on the CBS Early Show this morning when asked how he made his still unrevealed choice.
Obviously, the most important question is this person prepared to be president? The second most important question from my perspective is, can this person help me govern? The third criteria for me, I think, was independence. I want somebody who is going to be able to challenge my thinking and not simply be a yes person when it comes to policymaking.
There. Rick Klein, a senior political reporter for ABC News. Rick, do you think it's possible that Barack Obama will choose someone named Edwards this year?
I don't. I think it's very unlikely, and unlikely that someone whose name has not been part of the process at all. I think this is typical of the end stages of the deep stakes craziness, where a lot of names get floated and a lot of rumors and innuendo, but basically it's mostly reporters talking to operatives who are on the outside and then repeating the words in the echo chamber. So I think it's safe to assume that that it's not going to be Congressman Edwards, although it would be fun. He's actually President Bush's hometown congressman back in Crawford, Texas.
Well, let's continue to be in the echo chamber here. because we did want to ask, it seems as if the drumbeat for Hillary Clinton, you know, it's become one of those campaigns where every hour, maybe it shifts a little. It seems like the Clinton drumbeat has faded a bit.
I think that's right. We have heard very little talk about him possibly choosing Hillary Clinton, although we were at a fevered pitch a couple of months ago around the time that she dropped out of the race. It doesn't seem like it's very likely. I think Obama's calculation is that she doesn't check the right boxes as far as he's concerned, and there isn't much of a personal relationship there. Look, it's always a possibility, and I think it's something that certainly there's a conspiracy theory out there that suggests that all of this has been a dodge to set people up for the big coup that would really blast him into orbit out of the convention. But it does not look like it's likely at all.
Well, let's go to speculation on the Republican side. General Petraeus is stepping down from his role in Iraq for a new role. Some have speculated he'd be an electric choice for John McCain. Is that realistic?
I don't think so. It's not someone who's ever run for public office before, so there's a danger inherent in that. He's said before that he has no interest in pursuing that, although he's widely talked about as a potential White House contender 4 years or 8 years from now. Again, a lot of names got floated in the end stage, and I don't think it's very serious. There's nothing in our reporting that suggests that either candidate has deviated much from the shortlist that we've heard so much about. But again, this is a decision that rests in one person's mind on both sides, so there's always the possibility for a surprise.
Well, just quickly to the houses. Earlier this week, John McCain could not name how many he owned. ABC News is tallying them. The number, I think, is up around 10 on 8 properties. But the McCain campaign is hitting at Barack Obama, saying that he got his home through someone who is a criminal, and referring to Resco, the Chicago party. And, of course, Barack Obama is saying that's not entirely true. How much does this housing debate matter?
This is a bad mistake by John McCain, and I think the McCain campaign realizes that, and that's why they're trying to push back like the way they are, try to make the best out of a pretty terrible situation. They realize the way that this looks, particularly as they try to paint Barack Obama as an elitist. To go out there and say that not be able to name how many houses you own is a very difficult thing to overcome. Barack Obama has been hitting it on the stump. We heard Tim Kaine, one of the potential running mates, hit it yesterday as well, and I think it's going to be a major theme. But the McCain campaign is signaling that Obama will be sorry to have gone here, because they are going out there against some of his personal connections, raising Tony Resco, who's the indicted developer who helped Barack Obama secure the property where his house is on, and some other of his connections have suddenly come back into the discussion. This is a storyline, though, that I think is going to continue for some time.
Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
Well, staying with politics, but turning to your thoughts, we heard a lot of them after yesterday's conversation with Dr. Joel Hunter, a Republican evangelical pastor from Florida who helped the Democrats craft their party plank on abortion and will deliver the closing prayer at the Democrats' convention next week. Is Obama out of his mind, writes Gordon Posner of Tolson, Arizona. Gordon also questioned Pastor Hunter's comment to us that Ben Franklin called for prayer at the Constitutional Convention in 1787. Gordon writes, the pastor omitted the punchline. Franklin's proposal was rejected by the delegates, who thought prayer was unneeded and would be divisive. Well, David Offal, a mainstream Democrat from Charlotte, North Carolina, appreciated the conversation, especially the pastor's point that women who feel they can't afford a child need support. David writes, Pastor Hunter's thoughtful commitment to helping babies be born is precisely what's needed in this epic debate. Well, in another story, we referred to the car cassette player as obsolete. Ken Cobble writes, wait a minute, I use it for my old mixtapes. And Michael Pettengill of Merrimack, New Hampshire writes, what about audiobooks? Many libraries only have them on tape. Okay. Your point's taken. Caroline Ostermeyer and Scott Todd, school teachers from Salem, Massachusetts, wrapped my wrist for interviewing Lee Israel, an admitted forgerer whose memoir tells how she did it. Caroline writes, we try to instill a moral compass in kids. You put on the air a person who was positively glib about her lack of one. What shall we tell our kids? That it's okay as long as you're a good writer? Wrong. And we have a correction from Sarah Park Rankin in Mount Holly, North Carolina. I said that captured Serb leader Radovan Karadzic wore a hassock as a disguise. Sarah writes, madman though he is, I doubt it was a hassock, a padded footstool, especially if he was trying to remain incognito. More likely, he was garbed in a cassock, a full-length garment worn by many Christian clergy. And finally, Jenny Bosack of Davidson, North Carolina, asked, what was that music at the end of our conversation with the author of The Shack, the bestseller about spirituality and God and, in a brief mention, Bruce Cockburn? Well, appropriately, although how would you know, because I forgot to tell you, that song was Bruce Cockburn's A Lord of the Starfields.
Lord of the Starfields, Ancient of Days, Universe Maker, here's a song in your praise.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's HERE-NOW.org. Or give a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Still to come, film director Miloš Forman after the news, here and now.
Like a banner in the wind. Oh, love that fires the sun.
We're heading off after the show to Denver for the first of two conventions, even as we have a conversation right now about whether or not they really even matter. Once upon a time, they did make history.
A girl being carried off to a paddy wagon in something less than a nonviolent manner. It was supposed to be a nonviolent demonstration today.
Remember the protests outside the Democratic Convention in Chicago in 1968, or Barry Goldwater at the Republican Convention in San Francisco in 1964.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Dramatic moments captured on television, but terrible politics, meaning losing politics, according to our next guest. David Frum says TV has sucked the life out of conventions, turning them into scripted, meaningless events as opposed to history. David Frum is a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. He's author of Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. And he joins us to talk about his recent commentary about the conventions in the Wall Street Journal. David, you say the conventions are evolving. What do you mean?
There are two great things that changed the convention. One is television, but the second, and it's much more important, is the advent of direct democracy, the primary. It is the advent of the primary that transformed the convention from a decision-making body to a body that ratifies decisions elsewhere. So since the 1970s, these conventions have been showcases, ways that the parties make their case to the country. But they don't always do that so well either. And as the parties have become better and better at using these conventions at showcases, they have to become more and more careful about anything bad happening. And that's, in a way, killed the show, but the parties have killed the show out of self-defense. So my article in the Wall Street Journal tried to figure out, instead of just complaining about this, let's acknowledge the way that the convention has evolved and say, now, how can we accelerate that evolution to make the convention again a useful thing in American democracy?
And you give us more examples. You write about the first night of the Republican convention in 2000. There was country music, an interview with a former Miss America who talked about the strength of the Texas public schools under Governor George Bush. There were video presentations called Profiles in Compassion, a speech by a Latino single mother. Terrible television, you say, because it was so scripted. But good politics, because in your definition of politics, George Bush won, as opposed to 1972, when George McGovern made that late-night speech. Because television was there, you could see his party rivals on stage. They were angry and scowling. Again, that was great TV, but maybe terrible politics. McGovern lost.
When George McGovern spoke at the Democratic Convention in 1972, he was doing a very old-fashioned thing. Now, that was the way it was done from the 1930s until the 1970s. The candidate gave his acceptance speech surrounded by the other people in his party. But when McGovern spoke, it raised the question among the people organizing this thing, why do we have to have these people on the stage? Why don't we have the candidate alone? And since 1972, the candidate has always spoken alone. This year, we're taking one more step. The Democrats are saying, why does the candidate have to be in the hall at all? If we are making a television event, the candidate can speak from anywhere. In the case of Barack Obama, he'll be speaking from a football stadium. Now, that's not completely unprecedented. Kennedy did something similar but very different in 1960. In 1960, Kennedy arrived at the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles not knowing whether he would be the nominee or not. At the convention itself, his people decided, we're meeting on the University of Southern California campus, and we're in the covered stadium. It's kind of small, and it's only got room for the delegates, a lot of whom actually like Stevenson more than they like Kennedy. So at the last minute, they improvised, let's move across the street to the USC football stadium, bus in a lot of labor union people who like Kennedy, and we'll have a better show. If Barack Obama's speech is perceived as a success, it's going to occur to other candidates. Why didn't I speak in front of a shuttered factory, from the deck of an aircraft carrier, from the front porch of my humble boyhood home? Why don't I speak as Hillary Clinton did when she launched her campaign, probably the best speech she did in that whole campaign, from a living room?
Are you saying that's a good thing or a bad thing if candidates start to follow this trend?
I'm saying it's almost a certain thing to happen. I mean, you have to have a convention because the nomination of a candidate is a legal act. It's not just a political act. So the party has to meet to go through a formal process to have a nomination. But that's not where the candidate has to deliver his big acceptance speech to the public. That can happen anywhere. Barack Obama is showing us that. And I am saying a lot of people are going to look at this nostalgically as a loss. Let's look at it instead as an opportunity to make the convention useful again. Once the candidate moves away, there won't be so many cameras there. That means the party will have a little bit of peace and quiet to take some risks, which is right now something they cannot afford to do.
And you mean, I just want to clarify, that the cameras move with the candidate and move away from the convention, and maybe then what can happen back at the stuffy old convention hall while the camera lights are focused on the candidate? Right. What might happen back there?
Let's have every promising elected office holder under age, say, 40. Let them have a chance to speak on panels and participate. Now, right now, you would never, ever do that because you'd be terrified that one of them would say something untoward or improper or inappropriate. And with 4,000 journalists there, you can't take that risk. But when you have 40 or 60 journalists there, you can take that risk. You can have a real talent show and allow the members of the party who gather in this place to look at their future leaders and say, yeah, this guy looks promising. This woman looks like she might have some potential. Let's pay more attention. And it could be, for the party, what conventions are in any other industry, a place to talk about tomorrow with the candidate safely removed delivering his speech from the front steps of his humble boyhood home.
You give the example of Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, who is considered in contention for the VP slot on the Republican side, although some say he may be too young, just what you're talking about, that he's young.
Right.
And so he probably, if he's not picked for VP, there's a good chance the rest of the country won't meet this person that we've heard about so much. But if it isn't televised, then we won't meet him either.
With a lot of the people I'm talking about, it's not time yet to introduce them to the country. Bobby Jindal's already a governor. I'm thinking about people who are mayors or who are individual members of the House of Representatives or state legislators. Let's have some debates. There's never any debate at a convention, and there's a good reason for that, because a convention is a moment where, with all those cameras present, you need to show unity to the country. If the cameras are following the candidates somewhere else, then you can actually have some lively discussion. For example, I'm a Republican, and one of the things that we have to think about is, supposing the Democrats have a majority in Congress, do we work with them on a health bill or do we fight them? That's a good topic. A convention is a good place to have that discussion. We're not going to have it if there are 4,000 journalists there. But the journalists are leaving. That's a fact. There's nothing we can do about that. They are going. This forum is evolving. Let's not let it be like some abandoned urban landscape. Let's turn it into a revived urban landscape and put these old warehouses to new purposes.
Well, as you said, you are a Republican. Take us back to what would seem to be one of the last conventions before television had, you know, in your way of looking at this, really sucked the life out of conventions, and that's 1976, when it was close and contentious.
A convention that you would call exciting, the public tunes in and says, gee, these guys can't run an election, and thus poor Barry Goldwater, poor Hubert Humphrey, the dramatic convention loses. Gerald Ford did not get any benefit from that exciting 1976 convention. 1980 for the Democrats, you know, there's some dramatic moments of conflict between Carter and Kennedy. It didn't do the Democrats any good. They lost afterward.
Yeah.
The winning party has a unified convention. That's what the public wants to see. And I think the parties are now so good at this business, we're never going to have one again.
David Frum, former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, also author of Come Back, Conservatism That Can Win Again, also author of an article about conventions that appeared recently in the Wall Street Journal. David, thanks as always.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And again, we're going to be in Denver next week when the first ever African-American presidential candidate is nominated. But please join us on Monday. We'll speak to one of the first African-American Democratic delegates 40 years ago and their fight to get into that convention. That's on Monday. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm a cousin, you could be a cousin, I could send, I'm a cousin, I'm a cousin.
When the Czechoslovakian film Loves of a Blonde premiered in 1966 at the New York Film Festival, it caused a sensation and introduced the world to director Miloš Forman. His film received an Academy Award nomination for Best Foreign Language Film. But Loves of a Blonde featured shoe factory workers forced to relocate by the Czech communist government. His follow-up film, The Fireman's Ball, also commented on communism and was banned. So in 1968, Miloš Forman left his country for the U.S. just before Soviet tanks rolled in to put down a reform movement known as the Prague Spring. Forman says he never stopped making films about the effects of communism. Take, for instance, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Here's a scene with Jack Nicholson as a mental patient making a suggestion to Louise Fletcher's authoritarian nurse Ratchet.
Today, as you may or may not know, it doesn't matter, is the opening of the World Series. What I'd like to suggest is that we change the work detail tonight so that we can watch the ball game.
Well, Mr. McMurphy, what you're asking is that we change a very carefully worked out schedule.
A little change never hurt, huh? A little variety?
Well, it's not necessarily true, Mr. McMurphy.
Boston's Museum of Fine Arts is holding a retrospective of the works of Miloš Forman. Among the films they're showing, Cuckoo's Nest, Amadeus, and Loves of a Blonde. And Miloš Forman joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Well, I have to ask, Cuckoo's Nest as commentary on communism, we thought it was about Jack Nicholson as a mental patient taking on Nurse Ratched. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe there is something.
No, you know, I'll tell you, when I told some friends, you know, I was offered to do One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, they told me, stay away from it. Don't touch it because it's such Americana. You just came, you know, just fresh immigrant. How can you understand this kind of Americana? And I said, what are you talking about? This is a Czech movie. This is a Czech story. For you, it's a book. But for me, I lived it.
Yeah.
Communist Party was my big nurse. Telling me what to do, when to do, when to get up, what to say, you know, what to think.
Communist Party was Nurse Ratched.
That's right.
What else informs your films? I mean, we know from the reading, but many listeners may not know, that both of your parents were killed by the Nazis in Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, they were taken to the concentration camp, and the mother died in Auschwitz and father died in Buchenwald, you know, during the war.
I can't imagine that doesn't flow through your veins. I mean, I can't imagine that doesn't come out in some way, but, I mean, can you see a way that that impacts your work?
Well, it sure impacted my life because I had, and I think my work too, because, you know, to make movies, you have to know how to deal with people, and when you suddenly are alone and...
An orphan.
And depending on the nice strangers, you know, you have to learn how to not to antagonize people. Diplomacy.
Yeah. Well, you've said that, you know, that was one horrible phase of history that you lived through, but you lived through and have lived through so many different kinds of regimes, if you will, or politics in a lifetime.
Well, many, many. You know. Well, I was born into democratic Czechoslovakia, and then came the limited democracy before the World War II, and then came the Nazi occupation, then came a period again of relative democracy, and then 3 years later, communist took over the country. So, yeah, I was lucky or unlucky.
Because I'm thinking of some of the other films, Man on the Moon, the story of Andy Kaufman, Amadeus, you know, Mozart struggling to get past Salieri. You know, it seems as if a lot of the films are about outsiders, although most films are. You know, a film about an insider would be kind of boring. But I'm just wondering, you know, how much those characters, picking those films, reflected your own sort of moving around a global chessboard.
Well, it reflects, I guess, you know, the most important experience one has. I think it's a conflict between individual and institution. Because, you know, we as individuals, we need institutions. We create them. We pay these institutions, you know, to help us live, to serve us. And why always we end up being dictated by these institutions as if they are paying us to be obedient to them, you know? And this is a conflict which is, I guess, as old as mankind.
We'll have more with director Miloš Forman in 1 minute, here and now.
I'm here to cooperate with you 100%, 100%. I'll be just right down the line with you. You watch, because I think we ought to get to the bottom of R.P. McMurphy.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and that was Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, one of two films that won Milos Forman an Oscar for Best Director, and one that for Forman echoes back to his time in communist Czechoslovakia. Milos Forman, you say that at that time you were timid, not an activist, but through work like your film The Fireman's Ball, which is about a small town fire department organizing a retirement party that goes horribly wrong, you did needle the communist government.
Yeah, but, you know, I was lucky because my films were considered comedies, and so they were a little easier for the friends of mine or friends of this kind of filmmaking to defend the films, you know. They were metaphors, of course. The line which, I was told that the president of Czechoslovakia and the secretary of the Communist Party climbed the walls when he heard the line, "One fireman's wife steals something from the raffle," you know, and her husband, you know, is so upset and is bringing it back. And they go, "Why did you bring it back?" You know, and the other fireman says, "You shut up, because you would do the same thing if it happened to you, because you are an honest man." And the man answers, "Never. Because the reputation of the company is much more important than some stupid honesty." And that's just...
You know. And you start making plans to come to the U.S. because, oh. You know, the movie, the film was banned.
The film was banned officially forever. And I knew that if I go back, I would not be able to work anymore. So... I decided to stay.
Well, you left Czechoslovakia. You came to the U.S. to make Taking Off.
Yeah.
And you don't go back to Czechoslovakia for fear, with your exit visa being revoked, that you won't be able to leave. But you left your children. Didn't know when you'd see them again. You didn't see them for 8 years. I'm thinking especially someone who was cut off from your own parents. It must have been a very hard time.
Well, it was hard for one reason, because when finally after 8 years they allowed my sons to visit me, you know, when I arrived at the airport, I didn't realize that I will be total stranger for them.
How old were they?
When they arrived, they were 12 or 13, but, you know,
yeah.
I didn't see them
yeah.
since they were 5 or like that.
Because you were always thinking of them. So.
Why, for me, you are my children, my God, you know. And they were looking at me, who is this strange man?
A strange man who was also nominated for an Academy Award for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Was that part of why the communist government in Czechoslovakia allowed them to come, because they were starting to get kind of impressed?
Oh, yes. You know, it's such one of the paradoxes, you know. For the communists, you know, the whole West was a decadent, you know, dying society, capitalist society. But they didn't admire anything more than a success in the West, in the capitalist world.
Right. Well, I want to mention another, what some would consider, very American story that you tell on screen, and that's Hair. Full disclosure, as you know, my brother John Savage played Claude in
yes.
the film. Let's listen.
Where do I go? Follow the river. Where do I go? Follow the gulls. Where is the something? Where is the someone that tells me why I live and die?
I wanted to play that because he's my brother, but because I'm wondering also if that lost soul character of Claude, you know, where do I go?
That's right.
If that resonated for you.
Oh, yeah, very much so, because for me, I'll tell you, my personality was split when I was doing Hair. Because it's anti-war, anti-Vietnam War subject, right? But for me, anybody, for me, you know, who lived under communism and knew what it was, anybody who was fighting communism was a hero. So America was a hero, and here... I am in love with these songs, with these tunes, with this atmosphere of freedom in this anti-war musical. So for me, it was a little bit, you know, like schizophrenic
That's
situation.
Very interesting. How did that go over with the cast, the New York cast at the time? I remember the dance rehearsals in Central Park with Twyla Tharp and the headiness of the anti-war movement. How did they feel about your sort of hesitation about that?
I don't know how they felt. I don't know. I don't ask anybody. You know, film set, that's the last real dictatorship in the democratic society. So you just ask what you want and they have to give it to you.
You're Nurse Ratched
on the set.
All right. That's correct. That's correct.
Well, there's so much, but can we ask you also about the Best Picture winner, Amadeus, starring F. Murray Abraham as Salieri, the court composer wildly jealous of the young Mozart played by Tom Hulce, sort of an enfant terrible. He has the talent Salieri doesn't, as we hear in this clip.
This was a music I've never heard. Filled with such longing, such unfulfillable longing. It seemed to me that I was hearing a voice of God. Excuse me. But why? Why would God choose an obscene child to be his instrument?
Miloš Forman, you returned to Czechoslovakia, a changed Czechoslovakia, to shoot some exterior scenes. What was that like?
The first day or two were very emotional, of course, because suddenly I saw places which I didn't hope to see ever again. I met people, friends, which I didn't hope I will see ever again. But afterwards, you have to cut yourself emotionally, totally off everything except your work.
What are you doing now?
I'm hoping to make a movie in the spring, you know, which I don't want to talk about because it's not yet sure and I'm a little superstitious.
You don't want to jinx it?
No.
But can I just, does it have something to do with the writing of Václav Havel?
Oh, yeah, well, Václav Havel, we were kids together at the same boarding school. So we are friends since then. And as a matter of fact, if this new project will go ahead, we will work a little bit together on it.
Was this when you were orphaned?
Well, this was a funny school because it was created right after the war in 1945 for the kids who were left without parents. So because it was such a, you know, noble goal of the school, so government gave a lot of money. So the director put together the best, you know, team of teachers. The school got the old 15th century castle to be placed in. And suddenly the word that this is a wonderful school spread out. So suddenly not only the orphans, but the powerful people wanted their children to be at the school. So one third of the kids were real orphans, you know, left without parents after the war. The other third were children of a very influential and powerful capitalists. And another third were the children of even more powerful communist leaders.
I should know this, but which was Václav Havel?
Václav Havel was a child of a very important capitalist.
What a great story. Two boys in a boarding house post-World War II. One ends up leading the country, one ends up, you know, making films.
You know, Václav Havel's uncle built Barrandov Studio, which is the most important studio today in Central Europe.
Maybe that is the movie you're making and don't want to talk about. Director Miloš Forman. For more on Boston's Museum of Fine Arts retrospective, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Just a real pleasure seeing you. Thank you.
You're very welcome.